You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest TypeScript treats out there. Today, we've got a good one for you. We are going to talk about how to take a code base that is in JavaScript and convert it to TypeScript. What is the process? How do you tackle something like that? It probably seems so overwhelming at points that you think, like, is that even doable? Because it's certainly easier starting from scratch, but that's not the case in many applications. So we're going to get on into that. We're sponsored today by Sentry. Sentry is the amazing error and exception tracking service that you basically install in your application, whether it's a Node backend, whether it's JavaScript frontend, whether it's Python. Literally, it works with everything. And they will track all of your errors, exceptions. One kind of cool thing that they are in beta right now is session replay. Have you turned this on yet, Scott? I haven't done it yet.
I haven't turned it on, but I've been seeing that little message pop up in my dashboard. And I have everything else turned on, the performance stuff, the profiling, but not replays just yet.
So it seems pretty cool to be able to... I was having an issue where, like... Our course player, like one in like, I don't know, 100 requests, not even 100, but like basically every 5 seconds, we submit some data to the server to log the progress of how you're viewing the video. And there was like a weird issue where I'm not sure where it's coming from just yet, but I think Cloudflare is probably blocking a request if it happens too quickly after another one. But I needed some insight into that. So basically, I set up some error handling where I would explicitly catch it and then send that over to Sentry. By default, Sentry will just catch everything. But in my case, I wanted a little bit more information. So I sent that over. And now they're starting to pile in. I've gotten 2 or 3 this morning already, and it's just a bit more insight into what's happening. So pretty happy about that. You're going to want to check it out at sentry.io. Use a coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and that'll give you 2 months for free. Thank you, Sentry, for sponsoring.
Sick.
How's it going, Scott? I forgot to introduce you.
Oh, hey. No, it's going good, man. Hey, I saw you doing some electrical last night on Instagram, and I was doing the same. I installed 6 switches this weekend.
Wow.
And it's not a ton, but like it's enough. You know what? I did my first 4-way switch and a couple of 3-way switches. And I got to tell you, man, I had no idea after doing so many normal 2-way switch or whatever. Those are so easy. And then you get into the 3-way switch and all of a sudden the red's connecting to the black and the blue and the, you know, who knows? Like I had to like really get out my voltage meters. And you know what came in big time handy was that little label maker, the Nimbot.
There you go.
Because I would find the wires, I would find the common wire, and then I would label it. And the next time, the next person that goes in that outlet's going to pop open that light switch and be like, oh man, this dude labeled the wires for me. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild because often, at least in North America or at least in Ontario, there's like two, when you have a 3-way, you have 2 travelers, and the color of those is different. Sometimes it's red and sometimes it's black. Sometimes both of them are black and you don't know which one is the traveler. I've had it where they're white, which if it's white, you're supposed to mark it with a piece of black tape to show that it's a black wire. But some electricians don't, which is kind of annoying. It's kind of confusing to do that. I actually ripped out a bunch of the 3-ways and just moved the other switch into a coin cell operated. Leviton has these ones where you can just put and that was much easier than having to figure out all the crazy wiring.
And you just capped them all off or what?
You
capped off the ones.
You cap them off on both ends. It should never be an issue, but if for some reason someone ever puts power to this unhooked up wire, then it's an issue. So yeah, you cap them off on both ends.
Yeah. I don't know if I was that I mean, I guess installing the 3- and 4-way switches is kind of adventurous because you're really getting into it. Like
it's probably the hardest.
Yeah. I open it up and it's like, all right, we got 2 white wires and 2 black wires, but they're telling me that there should be 2 red wires and 2 black wires. Okay. I got 2 white ones. And then in one of the 3-way switches, there's a red wire and the white wire. So at some point the red wire becomes the white wire inside of another box somewhere else that I wasn't seeing, or you know, it's easy when red goes to red, black goes to black, and you know everything just works. And then the moment that you open it up and you're like, huh, this is not what I was expecting in here. especially with that four-way switch. When I took off the first switch, it was the four-way switch, and I didn't realize it was a four-way. I thought it was a three-way switch. So I had all my stuff ready for a three-way switch, and then I pulled it on, like, what is this business going on here? Then I found out a whole nother light switch that was connected to these same lights. By the way, quick question. Do you go all the way on the Wago, or do you go nuts?
I usually just go lever nuts, because I've actually been having a hard time finding the proper. I have a bunch of like Amazon ones, which are fine for low voltage. Like I fixed our vacuum lines with it and whatnot, but you should never use those for actual electrical, because they're not CSA approved.
Which ones? So,
I just went on Amazon. They're called lever nuts. They're just just generic ones. But if you want to use the like actual lever nuts in like 120 volts, you have to get the actual proper ones that have been, they have like the stamp on them and they've been approved by whatever, because you're not allowed to do anything that is against code with that stuff. But they're way better. The lever nuts the twist nuts always drive me crazy.
They drive me nuts. And you shove everything back in the box and you're like, all right. You know, I watched a bunch of YouTube that was like, all right, here's the ways to make them the best. You twist the wires before, you do everything. So I followed it, all of the, you know, best practices to a T. But yeah, I ordered a bunch of the 450 volt rated Wago, the Wago 221s or whatever they
221s,
are.
221s, yeah, those are the ones everyone uses.
211, yeah. Yeah, so I was thinking like, man, maybe I'll just go all in on these and just start, next ones I do, just start using these.
They're way better. Honestly, I just need to buy a big pack of them, because
that's what I did.
Like,
yeah.
With the lever, with the nuts, you have to, I always twist them with the linesman's first, and then you put the nut on, and it's so hard to get them all lined up perfectly and whatnot, and it works, but the Wagos are way nicer, especially if you like have to take it out again in the future, because twisting copper, there's only so many times you can do that before you
weaken it.
You weaken it. It's kind of putting those light switches in is not, by far, my least favorite thing to do, because you go from this like tiny little light switch that has a hot coming in and something going to the light, and then you got to add a ground, you got to add the neutral, which is packed in the back of the box. And then you got to add, like, usually you have to add little pigtails, because if you can't fit that many wires in a wire nut, then you got a pigtail to it. It's such a, and then you're like, all right, let me try fit this back into this tiny little box.
Yeah, it's funny. Fitting all of that into the tiny little, it's like the new light manufacturers, the new switches are so awesome, but it's like, how the heck am I supposed to fit this in here? You just fit it in.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. You got to be careful that you don't pinch anything on the way in.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
All right, let's get into moving to TypeScript. We are talking about this because I had just moved over my course platform to TypeScript. And Friday at 4:52 or something like that, I cleared the last TypeScript error and I hit zero. And I was so happy about it.
Oh, wow.
So we're just going to kind of go through. I know you've converted a whole bunch of applications. You've been on TypeScript for a while with yours. So we're just going to sort of like talk about how to tackle such a large project like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I personally, so I moved to TypeScript. And then now what we're doing is we're moving off of our API to do things just on SvelteKit, just because it's way easier. And like half the site, I would say more than half the site is now, but it is opening up some TypeScript stuff. So I've been pretty deep into the TypeScript errors as I go. So as I go, I move something over and then it uncovers some interesting things where working with the API is different than how I wanted to do it. And sometimes it gives me a chance to reapproach some problems or things that I had done before and clean it all up. So I've been doing a ton of migrating myself. So yeah.
TS. So are you moving your whole GraphQL API over to Svelte functions, or are you like moving that stuff off of GraphQL and just putting it in like a server side database query?
Svelte functions. So when we rewrote the site, the goal was to get at launch all of the data loading to be done via Svelte, just normal Svelte data loading. And that, for the most part, worked with the exception of like a handful of admin pages. So when we launched, it was like, all right, mutations are still hitting our GraphQL API. It's all using the same database. So mutations are a little bit more tough. They were all hitting the GraphQL API. Now I'm moving a lot of those over to Svelte Actions and then cleaning up some of, the, like I said, that admin stuff that I had left in there. Because it's like, you know, the admin tools are great and they're a lot of fun to work on, but they're also low priority for everything. So it's you do it when you can kind of situation.
Totally. So does that mean that you eventually will have no GraphQL API?
Yes, hopefully soon. You know what? All of these stem back to that initial decision to move off of Meteor, right? Because when we move off of Meteor, it's like, all right, what do you want to do? Do you want to have two separate applications? And we went with the two separate applications because at the time, the only other option would have been Next.js, really, to do that. So when we moved to two separate applications, it was fine for like releases. Everything was great. But man, coordinating that was such a small team and like honestly a project that probably doesn't need that. Like we're not using the external API for anything. It was just too much work and too much management for what essentially could just be like a PHP style site, like what we're doing now, essentially with Svelte Git.
That's really interesting. So you're just going in. Maybe we need a whole episode on this because I'm really curious on it. So I'll hold off on that. I think that'd be kind of an interesting show for us to do. Let's talk real quick about like why do you want to move to TypeScript? So I had a lot of people when I like posted my progress on Twitter. I had not a lot, but like a handful of people who were extremely against TypeScript and this type of thing, and it's kind of interesting to see that thing. So let's just run through some benefits to moving to TypeScript. The first one is like refactoring is so much easier. So there was a lot of stuff that I had in my code base that was in a specific file that I was like, I gotta move that thing, but I don't really feel like moving it because I don't know 100% of the situations where this thing is referenced. Although like VS Code has gotten really, really good at that. I always just been like, I'm just going to leave it there. Or like things that were, I had a property that was spelled wrong and I just like live with it for however long because I was just too afraid to change it and break something. And once I was on TypeScript, I was like, oh, just right click, refactor, rename that property and boom, all the types are updated. Anywhere I've used that property, it's all been done. So for me, at least, moving to TypeScript has made the refactoring so much easier, as well as like edge cases. I thought it was kind of funny that I don't often have a server crash, but I definitely hit a server crash due to a bot was trying to submit a form on my website and it actually found a little edge case. And I was like, oh man, if I was on TypeScript, I would have caught that definitely before it went through.
For me, I found a lot of situations where that like dreaded not a number would pop up in your UI or something, or just look little things where text or a specific HTML element was showing in my UI where I wasn't expecting it shown. And that's the kind of little things that it caught for me more so than anything. Like I always talk about like TypeScript as being like, it's not going to solve your bugs for you, but it's going to alert you where there could be bugs or there could be situations where there's trouble. And one thing I really liked when moving my application to TS is it found so many of those situations that aren't going to show up on an exception and error tracking service. They're not going to show up from any other way than just somebody sending you a message on Discord and being like, oh, hey, by the way, do you notice that this text looks kind of weird here or something like that?
Yeah.
It's finding those kind of issues, right?
Yeah, I think the super common one is what you said, is that you maybe have a label and you're inputting the course.name into that label. However, like for me, I have one course that doesn't have a description or doesn't have like a something like that, you know? So like that's an optional parameter and it caught that. And those are the things, like if you ever see something that says hello undefined on like an email or on a website, you go, oh, okay, they didn't catch it. You just assume, as a developer, you just assume, it's probably going to be there and it probably will always be there. But there's going to be a 1 in 10,000 requests where, okay, there is an issue here. And then it's kind of embarrassing to show that.
Totally.
What else here? Better DX, amazing DX is just amazing, the autocomplete the itself. Like if you don't like TypeScript, you probably at least like autocomplete, you know?
It's so don't you good. Like autocomplete?
Yeah. And like a lot of the autocomplete will work in JavaScript files in most IDEs because actually what's happening is VS Code is actually just running your code through TypeScript and trying to infer as much as it possibly can. However, at a certain point, you write a request handler function outside of the thing. It has no idea that that's a request handler. And at that point, you're dead in the water. So at certain points, you do need to describe your data, and having that 100% across the board is super nice.
Yeah. It helps you identify things too when you're working with third-party APIs or anything like that. I personally spend way less time looking at documentation because one of the things that I often do when I have the docs up is I'm just looking at what methods exist and what are their inputs and outputs. But now I don't have to necessarily look that up because my IDE is telling me what methods exist on any given property, what their inputs and outputs are. Not only that, but like sometimes you think you're working with thing, right? I think I'm working with thing. And so I do thing.property. And that property may or may not exist on the thing. And TypeScript is going to let you know if that property should be there every single time, no matter what. And it's such a big win and like a confidence booster when you're typing and you can see exactly quickly and clearly what's going on in your specific, like what is the thing I'm trying to access properties on at this very second. And your editor is just going to let you know, oh, this is what's here, this is what's not here, whatever. And it works really nicely. I love it.
So good. The two common ones that popped up for me a few times was first, you assume something is like a type, but it is an array of that type. So you try to access like course.title and it's like, oh no, it's an array of courses. So I have to loop over them. Or the other one that I hit a lot was I had refactored a bunch of my Axios requests. Now that Node has fetched natively, I refactored a bunch of the Axios requests into on the server side. I still use some of the features for Axios on the client side, but I removed all the server side ones. And Axios returns a response with a data object where the data is inside of that, and fetch doesn't do that. Fetch is just the response dot, and you can access your properties there. And I had refactor it and didn't forget about that, and it caught like 7 instances through my entire code base where it's like, I wasn't expecting a data property here. Like, what's going on? I go, oh yeah, totally. I totally forgot about that. And that was just like not something I caught at all. And if I did not have that in TypeScript, I would have had to wait for somebody to hit that route and that code to run in that exception. And then I would have caught it and look at my error exception, and it's just a nightmare.
Yeah, no, people often talk about like the big picture things of why TypeScript helps you so much. But I think it's really these like hundreds of micro instances throughout your workday where it really comes in the most clutch, like hundreds or even 150, 200 times a day. TypeScript is helping me just save micro amounts of time and brain power. I'm having to use less decision fatigue to make the decisions that I'm making because my editor is just helping me. So, okay, let's talk about the actual conversion process because we've now done like 20 minutes on light switches and why you should use TypeScript. So let's get into the actual conversion. So you have your code base, your code base is either all just willy-nilly JavaScript, or maybe it's half TypeScript, or maybe you're using JS doc style syntax and you want to go just as TypeScript files. Either way, the very first thing you probably want to do is add your TS config file. So that way you at least know what you're working with. And the TS config file is tsconfig.json. And I recommend starting with just a really nice default TS config and having it be very bare bones and then adding what you need. But for the most part, the major things that you're going to want to know in the TS config is that if you're converting from JS to TS, you cannot do it all at once. So you'll want to at least start with allow JS set to be true. And then personally, I would recommend setting strict to not be true at first, because it can be a bit overwhelming when you set strict to true. But this is one of those things that we'll talk about in this episode. There's a point of strategy here, or ideas where you have to say, all right, am I going to bite the bullet and just go totally ham on this thing, or am I going to ease in? And is it a, you know, really cold pool that I'm going to have to take a couple steps in at a time?
I decided to just go YOLO, and I put strict true on. So anyone who's not a familiar, strict true in TypeScript will turn on, I think it's 6 or 7 different strict flags in TypeScript, and it will do things like no implicit any is probably the most common one, meaning
yeah,
that
the big one.
Unless you explicitly type that a value has a type of any, then that will be an error. And that's good because generally you shouldn't have a value accidentally be any. You should say, yeah, I know what I'm doing here. This actually is any. And then along with that, there's a whole bunch of other ones, strict null checks, some stuff around bind, call apply, and some stuff around binding of this as well. So I was like, at first I turned it off and I was like, I'm just going to ease into this, you know?
Yeah.
And then I was like, you know what? Like, I don't feel like having to get into the headspace of these modules twice. If I'm going to go all in on typing these things, I really want to do it once, and I want to have to spend the 12 minutes it takes to get up to speed on what does this function do, you know?
Yeah. And honestly, you know, now that we've kind of even said that, I did a very similar thing where I started with strict to false, and I did that for a little bit, but you're right. When I got serious about it, there was like a sense of maybe you just leave strict true on and go from, you know, as strict as possible to start. I guess the time in which you'd not want to have strict set to true would be if you're feeling totally overwhelmed by it. If you have set strict to true and you open up your file and you say, I'm never going to get this done, or maybe
yeah, you're
not confident with TypeScript, you know, that could be a thing as well, where you're not feeling like you have a control over your types. If you're feeling like you're truly need to ease into it, that's totally fine. And you could set strict to false, and then that way you can start typing and get that confidence and that comfort with the types that you're writing before opening the gates of hell and having all of your code be red underlined.
yeah, definitely that like initial turn on is pretty overwhelming. There's a couple other configuration options, ES module interop in there. If you go back to the show we just talked about on converting from CommonJS to ESM, if you still have that, then you can turn that on as well. So next step we do is you need to figure out what your tooling is. So you kind of need a few different tools. First, you need a compiler, and the compiler is going to turn your TypeScript into JavaScript at the end of the day, so that wherever you were running it, whether it's you were running it in the browser, you're running it in a server-side runtime, those runtimes don't understand TypeScript. Even Dino, they don't understand it. What they do is they will strip all of the TypeScript parts out, and you are left with just regular old JavaScript, ideally the JavaScript that you had before you started this conversion. And the tools to do that are, there's a couple of them out there. Vite is probably the most popular one out there. Parcel does it. Then if you're on the server side, there is Vite Node. I use TSX, which is a tool built on top of ESBuild. And basically, anywhere I was running node start.js, I just ran TSX start.ts, and it will ripple through your dependency and convert all of the TypeScript files to JavaScript for you.
Yeah, you also need to have some kind of type checker. Now, this one becomes less important, I think, early on compared to later, because your editor will find a lot of the stuff as you're working on it. And you can even, there's an experimental mode in VS Code that will show you all of the problems at once. I think it's just under experimental show all problems. And that can work really fine when you're just getting started, because like I said, when you turn this on at first, there's going to be thousands of errors. And it's like, do you really need it to say, all right, there's 1,000 errors? I mean, maybe you can do it. It's good for hunting them, but you know, you're going to have enough to do so that you might not need to run TSC as a type checker, which TSC, by the way, the default that comes with TypeScript, TSC will type check your code without necessarily compiling it. So if you just want to check your entire code, you can run TSC. And I think the option is no emit. which will not emit any files from it. And that will just simply type check your code with your current TS config. And that can be really great for finding all of the errors. But if you have a giant output in your console of thousands of errors, it might be something you just run every once in a little while instead of running in watch mode. I do run mine in watch mode when I'm working because I like to see if something is up. But you
know. Maybe it broke something in a different file.
Yeah.
Other tools that you can use, MongoDB to TypeScript generator is something I use. That what it did is it took all of my models and converted them into like a types file. That was very helpful. Not for the schemas per se, because like I can quickly convert a couple schemas to it, but more for the like what methods are available on like there's MongoDB documents, but then you also have a MongoDB object which doesn't have the methods in it, and there's a whole lot to that. So what I did is I think the tool is meant to do like a one-to-one. What we did is I just ran it once. And then I was like, all right, this is our types file to start with. And then as I went through the code base, I just updated that types file as we were going. Because it wasn't perfect, especially with some of the custom methods and whatnot.
Yeah, there's a lot here. In fact, I could talk about this all day, considering I wrote an entire plugin for SvelteKit to do this.
Yeah. But
GraphQL CodeGen, if you have a GraphQL API, GraphQL CodeGen basically scoops up your schema and will spit out anything, whether that's fully typed React query or TanStack query functions or TRP, no, not TRPC because it's GraphQL, it just straight up functions or whatever, API calls, fetch calls, whatever. GraphQL CodeGen will do all of this fully typed. So if you have a GraphQL API, GraphQL CodeGen is like the thing for you.
Other tools, ESLint TypeScript. So I have a version of my ESLint config that is meant for TypeScript. So I flip it over to that. Actually, as I was going through the process, I had some JavaScript and some TypeScript. And ESLint has the ability to do what's called overrides. And you can say, okay, turn on the JavaScript ESLint for everything. But if it's a .ts or .tsx file, then run the ESLint TypeScript file on top of that. So that was really helpful. There wasn't a whole lot of TypeScript ESLint errors that popped up since the code base was already ESLinted as JavaScript, but it definitely did catch a lot of assignment of any variables as I was sort of early on.
I'm interested to know what's in your ESLint file. Maybe we can talk about ESLint in general in another episode. But
we should do it.
I'm interested to know what you're working with nowadays, because remember a while ago it was just, hey, everybody toss on the Airbnb one and call it a day. But I've since disagreed with a lot of the Airbnb stuff. So I haven't been using that in a little while.
Yeah, I still use the Airbnb one, but I've layered a whole bunch of that on top of it. And as I over the 4 years that I've had it, I've kind of tuned it. So yeah, we'll talk about that. Other tools here. I wish I knew about this earlier. Someone on Twitter messaged me or sent me a tweet about it. It's called DepRank. And what it does is it uses the Google PageRank algorithm, but you give it your entry point. So start.ts. And it will go through every single leaf of your application and figure out which files are most used and have the most lines of code. And then it will rank it based on that. And it will basically spit out a list of you should focus on these files first because they are the most depended on. Because we'll talk about that. You kind of want to start from the outside in when you're converting these things to TypeScript. So that's a cool tool. And then TypeSync as well, which will find type packages for things that don't have it. We'll talk about that in just a sec as well.
Man, I never heard of DepRank. This thing would have come in handy.
Definitely. I wish that I had heard about it before because I just sort of eyeballed it.
Yeah, that's kind of what I did as well. So, okay, next up, you'll want to start your refactor, which, is the big thing. Now, luckily for me, I was kind of writing a lot of these files from scratch. So I wasn't having to essentially create or change a .js file to a .ts file, what I was doing is I was creating a new file and then copying and pasting methods over that I had already had. So I'm interested to know, like, what was your strategy for renaming specific files? Renaming the file extension specifically, I should say.
I wanted to keep all of the Git history for the file. And by default, Git will track changes through a rename. So that's not a problem there. So my initial approach was I want to rename every single time I touch a file, I want to rename that to .ts, and then I work on that specific file.
Yep.
And that was going well for a couple files until I hit an issue, which was the compiler that I was using, ESBuild, would not import a TS file into an existing JS file. So I hit the problem where I couldn't import things. And it was an issue with ESBuild because it worked with TSC, but I wanted to just go all in TSX because I had to run on the server and I didn't want a whole build command and things like that. I just wanted to run it and go. So what I did is I just YOLO renamed every single file. I ran a little command in my command line and it converted every single file that had a .js or .jsx file over to the equivalent of the TypeScript file. And because I had already converted to 100% ESM, there was no fussing with .cjs or mjs as well. So that was really, really nice. I just went for it. And you can do that because JavaScript is valid TypeScript, meaning that you can write any JavaScript inside of a .ts file. And yes, there will be errors, but it will, you can strip the types out of it. So there's no issue with it. So I just went YOLO. I converted it all to .ts. And went nuts. Oh, one thing I wanted to say in the ESM show, remember I was saying how I needed to add .js to the end of every single one of my imports?
Yes.
In TypeScript 5, there's a beta out now. They added a feature to fix exactly that issue. It's called Module Resolution Bundler. Instead of Module Resolution Node Next or Node, it will do Bundler, which is what you want. And then it will do the, like, it'll check for a .js, it'll check for a MJS, it'll check for a .ts, and you don't have to worry about any of that. So I'm not sure if I want to just turn that on or, like, the deed is done already. So I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, that's one of the things. It's like, well, is this crucial right now for me to do, or am I just curious? Sometimes I get onto these just curious modes and I need to, like, pull myself back to say,
yeah,
hey man, you got some other stuff you got to do.
All right, let's talk about actual typing your code now. There's kind of two strategies to attack it, and pretty much it's as you go. And that as you go works well with renaming every single JavaScript file, because basically you say, all right, every time I did this when I refactored from async.js to promises and async await. I basically said, whenever I touch a file, you got to stop and convert the thing over, because, like, it's fine to keep it running as is, but whenever you touch it, you have to go ahead and update it. And that's a nice way to approach it, because sometimes there's literally not enough time in the day. Your boss doesn't approve the amount of time that you need to do it, or you just simply cannot do it all at once. So there has to be some sort of middle ground. And then the other strategy you have here is from the ground up, which is, like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, from the ground up is specifically going all in and saying, I'm going to do all of this in one fell swoop. I'm going to work overtime and just make it happen before, maybe not before I push anything, but before I merge this branch into main, the whole thing is going to be now in TypeScript.
Yeah. That's kind of what I did. So I forked my main branch. I opened a PR, and over about 2.5 weeks, I would spend a couple hours a day just going through the different files. And I was running TSC every time I did a change. And I would look at the list of, it would say, like, I started with like 2,700 errors or something like that. And it would say, like, all right, here it is. And then it would list out every file that has errors and how many errors are in each one. And I would sort of just, like, pick a file, do that, commit it, maybe do a couple more and then move on with something. Cause it's exhausting having to do this type of stuff. It's very involved. You got to really make sure you know what you're doing. It's not something, at least for me, it's not something I could just sit down and do it for 30 hours straight.
Yeah. it will really make you go nuts. I've been doing this kind of thing where I'll just sit down and be like, all right, now I got to move this thing to this thing. And I'm just going to stare at this for 8 hours. And by the time I'm done, I'm going to be a few hundred less TS errors. And like, that can feel a little deflating sometimes because you're like, well, I worked all day on this thing. My application runs the exact same or sometimes not at all. And the only thing that's changed is a number, you know, a number that says my code is for some reason better than it was before. So there's certainly ways where, you know, psychology comes into play in here, especially when you're looking at a big refactor. You're looking at essentially ultimately something that won't functionally have a difference to end users besides maybe finding bugs. But you do just need to have a strategy from the get-go. Otherwise, you can lose focus of that. If you're just like kind of going willy-nilly with it all, you might not have any real determined strategy. So you got to take a look at what exactly you want to accomplish from the get-go. And as you have a note here, you're going to have a ton of errors. And you're going to need to get comfortable with the thing saying your application has 1,000 errors in it or something, right? There's so many times when you open that up and it's like your application has 1,000 errors and you just look at that and you say, well, dang, I don't know if I'm ever going to fix that many errors. But
yeah,
you just got to focus on getting that number down, make goals for yourself. I'm going to get this down to 800 by the end of the day. And then you just work at hitting those goals and you do it till it's at zero. And you also have a note here, sometimes the number goes up and it can really truly feel like whack-a-mole where like you hit one and two more pop up. And that could be a good thing because you hit one and two more pop up, then you can knock down both of those. And sometimes that closes 100 other ones. So yeah. The number is fluid. It will be a bit of a roller coaster up and down.
It's really funny is sometimes you can, like for me, I had a lot of like routes and sometimes all I had to do was type the route as like request and response, and that would get rid of 30 or 40 errors. And then other times I would type a function. I spent like 4 hours on this one issue and I finally got the thing typed and then I reran it and it went up 20 errors. And the reason is that now that I actually typed that one function, it knows everywhere else in the application that it was not being typed properly or not being run correctly. Which is really frustrating. So sometimes that number goes up and other times it can go down by 100 just by installing a package or whatever. So it's really hard to like gauge. Like I always told myself, okay, I'm going to get this under 500 today. And then I would end up at like 629. I was like, oh, like it's hard to really know how many are there.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I personally, like the same thing, we have a lot of our own plugins and stuff. So for me, like fixing some of the core types in one of our own internal packages fixed every single form file on our entire site. So that knocked it down by like 200 or something. And that makes you feel great. It makes you feel like you just achieved something really, even though it's, you know, the exact same achievement as fixing something that only squashed one TS bug. But at the end of the day, it's making big progress. And that number getting smaller will definitely definitely get you going. Now, one strategy I have here is to start at the root of data definitions and work out towards the leaves, especially like, let's say you're on a component, if you're doing UI stuff, and that component is like the end of the line. It's the leaf of the whole tree branch, right? And this thing is the end of the line here. So instead of trying to fix the types in that thing first, maybe if this is a website, you start at that root of that route, the root of the root. You start at the root of the route and you fix all those types. You make sure that type is coming in from the data there. And then you work down to the component because otherwise what might happen is you could say, all right, this component needs this specific type. And then maybe something doesn't satisfy that somewhere up the line. Maybe you can get some confusion there. But if you start at the root of where the data is coming in and follow it through your component, then you, in my experience, you'll spend less time playing whack-a-mole.
Yeah. I found that as well is I would sometimes start at like a controller that would handle checkout or something like that. And then I'd go, okay, well, this thing is not typed because the function I wrote to use it is not typed. So you go to the function and you go, okay, well, this thing is not typed because of this thing. And then you go to the next thing. And you basically just start zooming out until you finally hit the end of the road where you can actually type it. And then you got to work your way in. So what I did is, first of all, I did all my database stuff first. That was
database
key for me
because
so much. At server side, it's going to be primarily a lot of it.
How did you type your database stuff, I should ask? You just use that Mongo?
Yeah, Mongoose to TypeScript to generate it once. And then I sort of done it. And it also I kind of wish my database was like a little bit tighter before I did that because I had like a couple fields in there. This is really nice. It sort of like surfaced. I was like, I have never used that field. And I would bring up my database tool. I'm like, are there anybody in the database that actually uses this? And I go, oh,
Command
no.
And, F. Huh.
And like, I never would have found that in not a TypeScript code base ever because I would just say, oh, yeah, it's in the schema. It must be used. But I probably added it 6 years ago and never ended up using it.
I have some stuff to tell about here in another episode. We can go deeper on this. But, you know, this is a good opportunity if you're out there and you don't have your data modeled necessarily, or maybe you're not using an ORM or something like that, and you might be looking for, this is a perfect use case for something like Zod, because with Zod, you can take Zod and like schema all of your data out, and then you can infer the types directly from that schema, and then you can use those types up and down the stack. And furthermore, like what we do with it is I use it and I run it through a Zod to JSON schema function, and that spits out a JSON schema. And if you don't know this, MongoDB has built-in data validation, but it has to be through JSON schema. So you don't have to use Mongoose or whatever to get data validation. And so from my Zod schema, I can not only parse my data that's coming in or out, but I can also validate it. I can use it for my database validations. I take it one step further, and then I use that same conversion to make a auto form. So it like generates all my forms for me. But
so good.
It's so good. I can talk all about that. But either way, it's a good opportunity to use something like Zod to schema out your data, and then you get the types for free from that schema. In the past, we had handwritten all of our database types, and that was just like a giant, giant pain in the bum.
Yeah, yeah. That's especially if you change one thing, and then like there's a kind of a scary thing there where if you change your database schema and you don't, if you've handwritten your database types and you don't update that, then you basically, when you create a type, you are telling the application, this is what the data looks like. And TypeScript will trust you from there on out. And if that's not one-to-one with your database, there's a potential issue that pops up there, right? Like it's not,
totally.
TypeScript is not a validator. So this type of thing would be really nice.
And let me tell you too, like, there is, in the past, what we had a GraphQL schema. We had a Mongoose database schema. We had our TypeScript types. Those are three things that, even though they weren't always one-to-one, because GraphQL can, you know, be very different in that regard. It's not one-to-one with your database. But those were essentially three schemas that were defining something just for the data to get from our database to our UI. Three separate essential schemas. And we kind of removed all that down to one Zod schema that now takes care of our database and our types. And then,
it's amazing.
Yeah. Big upgrade.
Let me run through the rest real quick. After I did database, I moved to utilities. So those are basically functions that are very simple because those utilities are used all throughout the code base. And you can knock those out. That's really good. Then I went through and made all of my unions. I have product codes, course codes, customers, country codes. I use country codes a lot throughout the thing. So I moved that from just being a string to a union of all of the country codes out there. That was really handy because anywhere I had a function that accepted a country code, it made sure that I was passing it data that was actually a country code and not just a random string that was passed over. Because there was certainly spots in the application where if you have the country of United States, that's not a country code. And if your types are strict enough, then you can catch that type of stuff. And that's really worth your time. I generated a lot of my types from just data that I had lying around in the thing. So a list of products, a list of code bases, a list of countries. All of those were converted to unions using asconst, and that was super handy. Then I pretty much just went file by file. I just kind of picked a file that had not too many. Like if I found a file that had 90 errors in it, I'm not going to touch that because likely there's something more down the tree. But if I found one that had 5 to 10 errors, I would probably just pick that one and just spend the time working on it. And when I finished typing it, I would do a git commit of just converting X area to TypeScript. And usually it was two or three files that you would touch by the end of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like sometimes, like I said, you touch, you only expecting to touch one, you touch a whole bunch because you have to.
I refactored a lot as I went, which is kind of funny because ideally at the end of your TypeScript move, your app will be no better than you left it. Meaning that like it should, best case, it works exactly the same as you left it. Worst case, you refactored something and you broke something along the way. So I refactored a lot of it just because I like looked at it and I was like this would be, sometimes with TypeScript, it makes you refactor it because you're not checking for undefined or there's a possibility that something is null or whatever. And then other times I was just like, this can be written. I'm not going to spend time typing this. It's faster if I just rewrite this entire thing. So
it depends on how old your code base is too, because if with an older code base, it could uncover a lot of, like you said, a lot of disturbing things. Things where you're like, I don't, you know, what's going on here? Why did I write this 10 years ago?
I had a lot of like util.promisify in there, which is basically taking the library and converting a callback-based function into promisify. And I was able to say, oh, like I've since updated those libraries. I can take this promisify function out of there. This thing is a pain in the ass to type anyway. And just, it's got first-class support for promises now, and I could just take that out.
Mm. Word.
Question for both of us. People ask me this. Where do you put your types? where do you put them, Scott? The answer is it depends, I guess. But like, what's your thoughts on that?
I tend to put every type like right next to where it's used. So, you know, specifically if I'm typing functions that are, you know, very specific type signatures, I'll often even make an interface for that function instead of typing it directly in line with the function just to make it easier. It depends if there is a lot of code that is being like, typically what I found is I didn't find that I had a lot of situations where I wanted to put just a type in a file and have that type available, because what I was having is like, let's say I have constant data that becomes as const. Let's say I have a schema that type is inferred from the schema. Let's say I have a function that type is defined next to the function. So there wasn't a whole lot of time where I was like, all right, let me have some types that I need globally or anything like that. So that's pretty much what I did, is I always kept it next to the exact thing it was describing.
Yeah, I do that as well. I will default to just typing it right above the function. And the beauty of that is that TypeScript knows where everything is. If you want to move it, it's not a big deal to move a type if you do need to move it. Whereas with JavaScript, I would have thought a little bit more about that. Because I was like, oh, maybe I want to move this thing later. So easy to refactor something out of one file into another and update wherever that file is referenced in the future. So I would just default, especially as I was writing the types, it's nice to just literally have it right above the function, because you can just scroll up 2 seconds and you're there, right? I have a couple, like I have like a types folder, and in that I would put all of my express types that were global. I would put all my module types that didn't have type packages. And then I would put any like user types, course code, country codes, all of those types of things. Those things are referenced throughout the entire code base. But I would say like over half of my types, maybe even 70, 80% are just literally in line in the function, or have like an interface or type above where it actually happens. And I just reference it directly from there. So where do they go? All the way throughout your code base. If you do it in a separate file, I would always just do it in .ts files. The .d.ts files are only used for typing modules that don't have specific types.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, one more thing. GitHub Copilot was amazing for this type of thing. I would just create like an empty type and put it in the function or define it into a variable. And then I would go back into the type and have GitHub Copilot scaffold it out for me, because it would be able to tell which properties on the object you're trying to access, as well as which properties were inside of conditional if statements. And it would put the question mark on them if they were question mark. And it would get me probably 82% of the way there, but without having to type anything. And then you go through it and sort of just check it, make sure it's all good. So that saved me so much time with GitHub Copilot.
So let's talk about like depths. You've kind of touched on this a little bit, but for the most part, your dependencies, in my experience, 90%, 85% of them will have types. Most of mine have had types. There are some instances where you'll need to type your own if you want. Now, I don't often reach for typing my own, or I'm sorry, before that, if there is no types for a package, always check to see if somebody has submitted types to, was it definitely typed? You posted a link to another tool somewhere else earlier in this episode, which is TypeSync, that will help with that process. But first and foremost, check to see if those types are available on the definitely typed. The easiest way to do that, besides just running that checker, I always just ran the install command. And if it came back as finding something, I was like, score, got it.
What I would do is I have a Raycast extension for NPM. And I just type NPM enter. I type the package name and then that brings it up on NPM. And beside the package name, there will be either a blue TS icon. That means types are built in. There will be a white with a blue border DS. And that means you can install NPM install at types / the name of the package. And that means a third party are putting them in. And then the third way is there's no types at all for it. And if that was the case, I would go to GitHub and search for the JS doc, because sometimes authors have JS docked it but have not exported it to. And if that's the case, you can just generate those into d.ts file. If not, then I would go on GitHub code search and search for declare module and then in quotes the name of the module that I wanted. And more than half of the time, somebody else has already, there's no package, I'll just type it myself. Someone else has typed it already. So you just copy paste, put it in your own project. Then you have it. And then the last way I had to do this for four different modules that were just tiny little ones is it's not there. So you just got to go look at how you've used the API and you have to type it yourself in a .d.ts file, which is you say declare module. For me, I had pushover notifications. This is a thing I use to send push notifications to my phone when I sell a course. And if that's the case, there was like an error function, a success function. There was a union of the different sounds that you can make the iPhone make. And I basically just had to type that all out myself by looking at the documentation and the source code. It didn't take too long. I just typed the actual methods I needed. And then if I need another method from that project, I'll just type it.
That's wild that you would go to the search for that, because once I hit that point, I'm just writing declare module thing in my globals file and calling it edit, because that will fix it. You just do declare module thing. And what that does is it sets the module as something that exists and who knows what's inside of it and you're fine.
Oh, so, really? No, that doesn't work, does it? You have to actually type the functions and types inside of it, don't you?
No, you just one-liner, declare module, then the name of the module. Like, for instance, I have one that is a svelte scroll 2, and I, let's see, when I, declare module, animated scroll. Yeah, it doesn't have any types in my project. What is it equal to?
But then, what are the functions and values? Are they just any?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But you know what doesn't complain about that is the no implicit any. So for some things, like it, for instance, I have the, svelte scroll 2. It's a one single function in my entire code base. Animate scroll dot scroll 2 and with the element name. That's it. So am I going to type this function myself? Sure, I could do that. Or I could just declare the module and move on for the day and say, all right, does this one singular function need to be type safe? Now, you get too many concessions like that and then your type checking is useless. So it's important to know when to do that, when not to do that. But there are certainly times where, hunting for the types and writing it yourself just straight up isn't an option. You just want to put any on it. That's a solution there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Wow. I didn't even realize that. I kind of wish I knew that. It wasn't that big of a deal to go ahead and type all the different functions that you need, but I thought you had to explicitly. For some of it is like some of the things return a promise or have a callback, and I had to type it because I needed to know that it was there. All right, next one, global types. Sometimes you need to type things that are globally available in your project. If that's the case, most common is environmental variables. So process.env.whatever, you can type those as a number or string or an array of values. And the other one is I have lots of middleware in my application. So through the middleware, I select the user and put the user on the request, and then the next request will have access to the user. Or check if somebody is an administrator. If so, put some information on the request and keep it going. Or depending on the domain name, put the course code in the request so that we can easily access it down the road. So a very common thing in middleware is basically adding those values to the existing types that a package ships. And that is very easy with the interface, because when you declare an interface with the same name as something that is also on the same scope, like try it yourself, make two interfaces with the same name and then try to use that type. Both of those values will be on it. That is something in TypeScript called declaration merging. And it allows you basically to, it's kind of like extending, but you're just adding it on top. The only time I ever had an issue with that is one of my packages had like request.cookies was typed as any. And that was really annoying to me because like, I guess cookies could be any, but I also, I wanted the names of the cookies to be in the autocomplete, knowing that like they're optional, like you have to check if they're there first. So what I did is I used PNPM to monkey patch the literal node module. And I know that you've done this in the past. I had never run across having to do this. And it worked great. Basically, what you do is you type PNPM patch the name of the module, and then it opens up this temp file. You literally go and edit the lines that you want, save it, patch commit, and then it like every time you NPM install it, will patch it for you. Well, you've used that in the past, right?
Yeah, I patch a couple of things. I patch a web component that I'm using that didn't expose styles and had like CSS variables to do styling, but they didn't expose enough CSS variables. So I wanted to add more. So I added more CSS variables with a patch. I have a patch for my JSON or my ZOD to JSON schema package because it was typing type date as type string, and I wanted it to stay as type date for my validation. So just like little things like that, right? Things that the author isn't going to merge that because that's not how the author wants the package. And if I want to have an option in there, you could, you know, do a PR for that option to give that an option is like maybe, but maybe the author doesn't want that. And then you have to wait for any sort of changes to go through. So sometimes it does make sense to just straight up monkey patch something, especially if it's something that you need. And especially if it's like a package you don't see yourself needing to change anytime soon.
Yeah, I was really happy with that. Because I always stayed away from it. I'm like, a lot of them were like post-install hooks, and I've never had success with post-install hooks. And I know some package managers don't do it, but this was a straight PNPM. Everybody who works on it uses PNPM, so I know that I can go ahead and use that.
Yeah. You have in here, sometimes you just got to use TSIgnore, like if you're just hitting a problem and you need to get past it, and maybe sometimes the types are wrong or weird. I'm proud to say, Wes, I did a command F for TSIgnore in my entire project, and there are zero instances of TSIgnore in my entire code base. So shout out to me for that one. That was pretty great. But yeah, I do like totally agree. There are some times where things just don't work right. I got a weird one, right, where I'm using Braintree as a node package and Braintree drop-in UI, and the UI one is for the Svelte side of things, and the Braintree node package is for the Braintree node stuff. And for some reason, which you probably would know, the drop-in types are overriding the node types. So anytime I go to use Braintree on a node interface inside of node code, it only gives me the types for the drop-in UI thing. I would imagine two things are named the same and they're both trying to auto-load or something. I have no idea what it is. So I had to get a little creative there. But there are some instances where you'll just hit issues like this where things will just not function like you expect them to or want them to. And sometimes it's just straight up not your fault. Or at least I'd like to think it's not my fault.
Totally. Sometimes it's out of your control. So in my case, the types were straight up wrong. and it was related to something with my checkout, and I'm going to rewrite my checkout in 6 months from now. Anyways, it's just not worth fussing with right now. I'm not going to go and fix the types for it because it's not worth it. So you pop a good old TSIgnore in there. And what that will do is it will tell TypeScript to literally ignore it. Intentionally, you cannot TSIgnore multiple files at once, which is TypeScript being like, you're going to use this? All right, bet. Let's see, you know? And it says, if you really want to TSIgnore eight of these lines, you got to type it 8 times above every single line of code there. So it's not something you can use easily, but it's certainly there if you need it.
Yeah, totally.
Also, one thing I did when I finally hit zero TypeScript errors, I did a grep on the code base for any, because as I was typing, every now and then I would throw an any in there. And what an any is basically it can be any type, because I didn't know what to do at the time, or literally could be any type. There was no types for it. And then I went back to that. I did a grep and found any place I used any. And I went back and I tried to fix all of those. And in most cases, now that I had better types for everything else, I was able to go back and actually fix it. And I only have, I think, 4 spots in the entire code base where I have a explicit any. And those are all legitimate. Most of them are high order functions that take literally anything and return anything.
Yeah, I do have, you know, my usage of any are oftentimes where it's like, here's a record with a string and a property of
yes.
any. yeah, that's definitely something that I used. Now what? Now that you have done all this stuff, you've converted your code base, you've done everything, and you're sitting there like, great, party for me. I've got my code base in TypeScript. Now what? Well, now you can take advantage of a lot of the wonderful things that TypeScript has to offer post all this stuff. For instance, you can now utilize things like GitHub Actions or any continuous integration stuff to block pull requests or releases from your code before it has fully been type checked or type saved. Like now you can say, hey, so-and-so, you're trying to push an update to this code base, but it's failing this type check. Our code base needs to stay zero type errors. So now you can block those things and have a conversation or potentially find bugs before they happen. But basically, now that we have completed the task, we can actually use this thing as a security tool, as like a security for you not making mistakes or your code being type safe in a way that it was meant to be, as a fully type checking of your entire application. So it's congratulations, you've made it. You can now use something that type checks your code. What a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Yeah, that is really nice. Like a lot of people on Twitter are like, what's the point of this? Like, why is this so painful? Anytime I hit like a funny issue or something that I was running into, people are like, seems awful using TypeScript, you know? And it's converting it can be awful. It's very hard, but there's a reason why people endure it. Like it's not... we're not all just hipsters trying to use the next thing here. Literally, it's helpful for your code base. It's helpful for the end product. It's helpful for developer productivity, all of that type of stuff. And once you do have those things in place, things get a lot easier. And I think you can, at the end of the day, you can build a better product and sleep better at night.
Yeah, totally. Cool. Well, that's it. That's converted. You've now done all the work by listening to this episode. So get out there and type check your code. It's a lot of fun. Yeah, there will be points where you'll feel frustrated, but honestly, I've done it. Wes did it. It's not that bad. And trust me, you'll come out on the other end of things being way better at TypeScript. There's like a few things I think that will get you much better at TypeScript. And converting a whole code base is one of those things. Another thing might be typing like library code. Typing library code, you end up having to get into more generic kind of stuff and more interesting types. But typing and retyping a whole code base will get you substantially more comfortable with TypeScript just straight up. Let's get into the part of the show where we talk about sick picks, things that we pick that are sick. Sick as in stuff that we like and we think is cool. Wes, do you have a sick pick for us today?
I'm going to sick pick some LED lights. Eight months ago, I sick picked a bunch of these Barina LED shop lights. And I since bought my dad a whole bunch. And now I was working at my workshop And I ordered the monster ones, 8 foot long ones. And they are so extremely bright and honestly the best. If you have like a dim basement or workshop or something where it's just like a garage, mm-hmm. or just like, man, I wish the light was a little bit better in here. Go out and get like a pack of these for $100. You can get 8 of them or 10 of them. I'm not sure exactly how many you get. There's all kinds of different sizes and whatnot. And they work great. They provide options to daisy chain them. So you plug it in at one end, you can hardwire them. I ended up converting some of my like fixtures just to plugs, and then so that they're switched.
Mm.
It's unreal. I can't believe how nice and bright, and just it makes the space just so much nicer when you have good lighting and that type of stuff. And this is such an easy project. So check it out. Barina LED shop lights. I'll put the link in the show notes for them.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I did our basement storage area had those old school tube lights that like explode when they touch anything.
Yeah. And they suck energy.
They suck energy and they're dim. They have weird refresh rate kind of deal going on. So I pulled those things. Also, they hang down, right? They hang down so far because they get really hot. But
yeah.
Then you move anything and you accidentally hit one of them and then it explodes above your head. And it's, yeah, it's a whole thing, you know,
no good.
Clumsy people, right? So I ripped those out and I did like you did. But I think mine were like the 3 foot. I did like a 6 pack of the 3 foot ones and I daisy chained them to have like 2 long sections that are probably about like 9-10 feet long. And then I just plugged them into the ceiling and oh my God, it's like daylight down there. It is shocking.
Yeah. I just can't believe it. Like, honestly, everybody needs to do that type of stuff. I've had a bunch of them for in our old place. We've had them for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. The only weird thing about LEDs is that when the fixture dies, you throw the whole thing out instead of a light bulb. I don't know, six years into a couple of them running 5-6 hours a day, and they've been good so far.
Yeah. I'm going to sick pick a USB-C outlet, wall outlet. It's a normal wall outlet that has a USB-C and a USB port. We talked about these before on this show as being like one thing that we'd like to get into or try. I ended up going with this brand ELEGRP, which I did not hear about this brand before, but they're not some like crappy Amazon one, even though they do sell them on Amazon. So, you know, that was always my concern with looking for stuff on it. Like, I don't want to buy some weird electronics to put into my wall, especially if it's an outlet. But this thing was really well made. It had great reviews. People were talking about it outside of Amazon, which is always a good thing because, you know, most of the Amazon reviews are probably fake anyways. And I got to say, this one has a USB-C and a USB. It's a 20 amp outlet. And the USB-C charges relatively quickly. The big concern was like, all right, you get this outlet that has a USB-C and a USB, and then it's not going to charge as nicely as your fast charger normal outlet. So what's the point? Well, I've been using the USB-C to charge my phone while I'm doing the dishes because we put one of them in the kitchen, on the kitchen counter. Great place for it on the kitchen counter, by the way. And it's fantastic. It charges really quickly. Again, not like fast instant charge, but let's be honest, like I really don't need my phone to be at 100% all the time. Sometimes you just need a little extra juice. So I've been using this outlet. It installed nice build quality, nice install. I've installed a couple of them. It has like the protection for kids shoving stuff in the outlet or something baked in. So
the tamper resistant. I freaking hate that. It's so hard to plug anything in.
I hate it, but at the same time, but my daughter almost started a fire. She was like playing with like a thing and it had like a metal handle and she dropped it and it landed on a thing that was connected to the outlet and it caused a spark.
Oh, there you go.
And it was very scary.
It saved you.
It saved us. Yeah. So tamper proof outlet is extremely important in our household right now.
Oh, that's good. Just for anyone listening, make sure you get the equivalent 20 or 15 amp. You put it in the kitchen. So you probably had 20 amp there. I've never seen anything with this plug. You know, like it's got that little extra little boop off the side of the left-hand plug.
Mm.
The idea is that eventually all kitchen appliances will have plugs like that, but I don't think it's ever going to happen because people, imagine getting something you couldn't plug into a regular 15 amp.
Yeah. So you're saying that you have to install this in a special amperage outlet?
Yeah. So the ones that have like a 15 amp is just 2 eyes.
Mm.
And then a 20 amp is an eye with like a little T on the side on the left. And that's a 20 amp outlet. And theoretically, if that is installed on a 15 amp circuit, you could plug in something that draws 20 amps, like a space heater, and you could overload the circuit. Will that ever happen? I've never seen anything with that plug on it, and your circuit breaker should flip. But
I was going to say, in that case scenario, that the breaker flips.
Yeah. Your breaker would flip before that type of thing, because your device would be drawing too much from it. So there's multiple protections there.
Would an outlet tester find that as a problem?
No. An outlet tester can't test. Basically, the difference between 20 amp and 15 amp is the thickness of the wire. Generally, yellow wire is 20 amp and white wire is 15 amp. And it would know that.
Because the outlet that I replaced it did not have one of those reset toggles on it, did not have a fuse on it. So I'm wondering if it was.
Oh, we're talking about that's something totally different. That's GFCI.
Sure. But I was just thinking that being in the kitchen and all. I don't know. There was nothing specific about the wiring that led me to believe it was any different. So maybe I didn't get the correct one.
Oh, well, I'm sure you can figure that out pretty easy. Do you have a GFCI anywhere else in the kitchen?
Yes.
It's probably, you only need one GFCI and the rest of the plugs are downstream from that. So the way you can test that is plug something in, push the test button on the GFCI, and if it turns off, then you're good. So this is electrical hour with Scott and Wes.
Yeah, right. I've been deep into it. Also, we got to talk about workbenches and stuff, because I got a workbench plan myself. I want to move it indoors.
Oh, we should. Maybe we'll do a not coding show, because it's kind of interesting. We bought a bunch of these USB ones for our beside the beds. So handy, because you don't have to have the brick anymore. And like my wife always takes the brick with her when she goes like to a hotel or to the cottage. And I was like, don't move the brick. So now you can't. It's screwed to the wall.
And so you choose the 15 amperes for those.
Yeah. I'm not sure. It's a 15 amp plug. What the charge rate is, I forget. I think the USB one is high. I think it's only, I think ours are only 14 watts.
Mm.
So the one you got will definitely charge faster than the one we got. That's actually pretty good. Yeah.
Shameless plugs, levelup.video for all of your video tutorial needs.
Oh, westboss.com/courses for a list of all my courses. Check it out and use the coupon code Syntax for $10 off. Thanks, everybody. Catch you later.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.